how do you want to take it forward? You want to ask questions first or go through the slides, or how do you want to do it?
You want to see this red. I think we'd like to go through the slides, if that's okay,
because okay,
I
fine.
Think most of the comments are sort of incremental and give you all a chance to ask questions as we go as well.
We'll try to go quickly before our heads start looking like cartoon turkeys. So good morning, everyone. Our main objective today is to provide you with an update of where the project is and on some recent decisions on disclosure transition and some other relevant topics since we last spoke to you in November. We also thought we might take this opportunity to get some feedback from you on the staff's latest thinking on licenses. If we go to the timeline that's on slide 3, you can see that it hasn't changed much since we last spoke, but we are much closer to the end of it. After 2 exposure drafts and extensive outreach, the boards have finished their substantive redeliberations, and the staff are now drafting the final revenue standard, which is scheduled for issue this year. As you can see, and we'll discuss a bit later, the boards tentatively decided at their meeting last month that the standard would require a retrospective or alternative transition method and would have an effective date of 1 January 2017 with no early application permitted. And as we'll discuss in a bit, the boards are discussing that early application decision this month again in March. The next couple of slides are just for your reference, but we won't really spend any time here. So if we go to slide 6, as I mentioned, the boards finished the substantive redeliberations last month, and the topics that were discussed are listed here and include topics like licenses, the constraint, disclosures, and transition. So the next few slides walk through the tentative decisions on each of those topics. And you're welcome to ask any questions that you may have as we go. And we'll also pause for a little, we'll pause for a little bit for your comments and feedback on licenses, but we'll aim to leave a good 10 minutes maybe for disclosures and transition at the end. So on the next slide, we go to collectability. And the boards discussed this in November, just after we spoke to you, and they confirmed their decision that the transaction price is not adjusted for credit risk. The boards tentatively decided, however, not to require customer credit risk as an adjacent line item to revenue, as proposed in the 2011 ED, but instead to require that this amount is presented prominently as an expense in order to keep credit losses together. In addition, the adjacent presentation that was in the 2011 ED implied a correlation that doesn't necessarily exist between the recognition of current period revenue and any impairment losses recognized in that period, so this fixes that as well. Another topic that may be of interest is the allocation of the transaction price, and as with many other topics, there were no substantial changes here. But the boards tentatively decided to clarify that residual estimation techniques may be appropriate when estimating the standalone selling price of a good or service. For example, in contracts where there are 2 or more goods or services with highly variable or uncertain standalone selling prices. There was also a small clarification that discounts may relate to more than 1 item in a contract. So on slide 9, the constraint, when we last spoke to you in November, we explained 3 approaches that the boards were considering. At the November meeting, the boards tentatively decided to move the constraint back to step 3, but this should not affect the amount of revenue recognized. The boards tentatively decided to clarify the objective to say that an entity should recognize the revenue at an amount that should not be subject to significant revenue reversals, i.e. downward adjustments, from changes in the estimates of the amount of variable consideration that an entity is entitled to. An entity should reassess this objective as the facts and circumstances change. The boards tentatively decided that an entity would meet that objective if it has sufficient experience or evidence that supports its assessment that the revenue recognized should not be subject to significant revenue reversals. The boards tentatively decided that the assessment is qualitative and that the entity needs to consider all the facts and circumstances associated with both the risk of a revenue reversal arising from an uncertain future event and the magnitude of that reversal if the uncertain event were to occur. The boards also tentatively decided to retain the indicators in paragraph 82 of the ED, subject to some improvements to help entities in assessing whether to recognize revenue based on estimates of variable consideration, including estimates of price concessions. So then we get to licenses on slide 10, and this is another topic that we spoke to you about in November. At the November board meeting, the boards tentatively concluded that some license arrangements represent a promise to transfer a right, which would transfer at a point in time and therefore would be a performance obligation satisfied at a point in time, whereas other licenses represent a right to provide access to the entity's intellectual property, which would transfer over time and would be a performance obligation satisfied over time. So on the next slide, the November staff paper on licenses described indicators of when a license may represent a promise to transfer a right. However, the feedback that we received suggested that this would be difficult to apply in practice. And so as a result, the staff performed further analysis to achieve more clarity around the differentiation between a license that perhaps is a transfer to a that represents a promise to transfer a right and the license that represents a promise to provide access to the entity's intellectual property. So based on questions that people have asked about licenses in the recent outreach, we think that it's important to note here that first applying the separation criteria from the revenue ED is key, and because you need to see if the license is distinct. When the license is not distinct, an entity would account for the bundle as a single performance obligation, and the accounting for the license would be dictated by the goods and services in the contract. If, however, the license is determined to be distinct, as mentioned in the previous slide, then the entity would determine whether the license transfers a right at a point in time or provides access to the entity's intellectual property over time. So this is where we would like your input on these criteria. In order to operationalize this view, the staff have developed the criteria on part B of this slide, slide 11, to determine if a distinct license is providing access to the entity's intellectual property. The factors to consider are whether there is an explicit or implicit understanding that the entity will maintain or enhance the related intellectual property, and whether the customer can automatically benefit from any changes to the intellectual property as and when they occur. If a distinct license does not meet these criteria, then it would represent the transfer of a right at a point in time, which would be a performance obligation satisfied at a point in time. If we can stop to ask, do you have any comments on this?
Yes, Bob.
In response to licenses, as you may know, is a major part of our business. I think you've nailed it, actually. On B, the and between 1 and 2 is significant as an and not an or, because of bug fixes and things like that. I just want to get sure that, and I think I know the answer to this, that you're identifying separate performance obligations. So in our business, a big thing we have is license plus software assurance. And you can have a license by itself, or you can have license with software assurance, which means that if we develop the next version of Office, in the time period you got your contract, you're going to get that new version. If you bought a license only, you wouldn't. That's bundled as one sale, one SKU, if you will. But I think the way I look at this is that you first need to go in and look at the separate performance obligations that would bifurcate those two items, and then the license wouldn't meet the and here and be recognized up front, but the software assurance would meet the and. Is that a correct interpretation?
Yeah, and that's exactly right. And I guess these factors are just meant to help you assess, I guess, which way to go on the license. So In terms of the software service, the PCS or what have you, you wouldn't necessarily need to apply these criteria to that service because it, just like any other service, you'd assess what it is you're doing. I think the reason why we ended up where we did with these indicators is because there's a lot of things that we put in this bucket of a license, but it's not always clear what the entity's job is or what their performance obligation is in relation to that license. So we're just trying to help here, try to clarify what it is that the entity is doing and how that sort of translates into the performance obligation over time or point in time. But I think your sort of analysis of doing the separation, you have your software license, PCS or update, that's correct, and then you'd assess just your software license against these criteria, and I think they would fail and end up as a transfer of a right, I think, in most cases.
Well done, I think, the way I read the words. So. Comment?
That's helpful. Thank you.
Allison, I want to ask the obvious question. If I purchase the license and it gives me a right for something over time but I have no clue when, how do I, as the purchaser, split what part comes into amortization now and what part doesn't because it's not yet in use? Because the seller has the bifurcation of the revenue problem, but I've got the bifurcation of the amortization problem.
Yeah, and that was something we were thinking about a little bit as well, because you may recall in the ED we had it may seem off topic, but bear with me, but we had a piece in the constraint that said when you have a sales-based royalty, it ends up for a license of intellectual property, you end up getting revenue over time, and so we were thinking about that circumstance in relation to this. But also in relation to that paragraph with sales-based royalties. And I think I understand that practice is actually quite mixed from the customer's perspective in terms of how they account for purchase of a license. And certainly if a customer is paying over time, my understanding based on practice today is that they're not necessarily recognizing those future payments, particularly if they're in the form of a royalty upon initially buying that license. But unfortunately, we just sort of looked at that in terms of helping inform our discussion about sort of the constraint in terms of the sales-based royalty, but in terms of these indicators as well. But unfortunately, just due to natural scope limitations, I think we were just trying to focus on what the entity's performance was here.
So this will be another one of these. It's going to bounce back to this variable consideration. For the
exactly. It will be something which we spoke in the afflict side of it.
Yeah. You're continuing to do some outreach activities, I think.
Right.
So which, I come from the pharmaceutical industry, and I think you're having an outreach with some of our industry members.
That's right.
Which other industries are still causing concern for you?
Well, I think... soon I won't be able to say this, but this thinking is actually quite hot off the press in terms of that the staff really developed this over the last sort of month or so, and we're just sort of starting to go out and talk to people. So what we're trying to do is talk to industries where licenses are most relevant. So pharmaceuticals, you're absolutely right, we're trying to talk to some people in the pharmaceutical industry. Software, we've had some conversations already with some software people, and we'll continue to have that. Media and entertainment is another industry where we have some outreach planned with them as well, and I think that covers it. But we are trying to talk to as many industries as we can think of that sort of where licenses is very relevant.
So this is a joint proposal by both boards, because I mean I understood the U.S. FASB were just wanting to spread it, is that correct? That was their standpoint?
And I think when we spoke to you in November, I think we actually had sort of three views on the table, which we were then calling sort of view A, view B, view C, and that really represented the spectrum of views. Majority of the FASB were closer to sort of what we called then a view C, which we documented in the November paper, which was broadly thinking about more licenses over time because of their terms and restrictions. and whether it's a whether the license was a perpetuity or a term-based license or not. So that is where the majority of the FASB was, but the majority of the ISB was in View A, which was more the 2011 ED. And where we've come up with here is really sort of the middle ground between those two. And what this staff thinking does represent is sort of the latest staff thinking from both the FASB and the ISB. But it's not, you know, in my mind, it's not a departure of where the boards were. It's just trying to take that view that the boards had, that some licenses represent access and some licenses represent a right, that it was a joint decision, just trying to figure out how we can actually put that into practice. With the ideas and concepts that they had in that we had in the November paper.
Allison, when are the boards scheduled to discuss this again?
Well, at the moment, because the boards gave us direction on View B, and what we'll have to do after we finish the outreach is think about whether what we end up with is different from the board's decision. So this is very much in the sweep issue category at the moment, so we'd have to think about whether what we've come up with is not directionally consistent with what the board's decided in November. Shall we talk about the other remainder issues?
If we go to slide 12, this is a topic, contract costs, where there were no changes made during redeliberations. The boards tentatively decided to retain the proposal in the 2011 ED, which is that an entity should recognize as an asset the incremental costs of obtaining a contract if the entity expects to recover those costs. This also includes the practical expedient that permits an entity to recognize those costs as an expense when incurred if the amortization period of the asset the entity would have otherwise recognized is 1 year or less.
Perhaps you covered it in what you've just said at the end, but you know, I've always had a bit of a problem with capitalizing these costs. I mean, if you look on slide 12, you say you can even capitalize pre-contract costs. Well, how let's say you're incurring costs over a two-year period, and you don't know whether you've got a contract until you've got the contract. So you can't. How can you capitalize pre-contract costs when you're not sure you've got a contract?
I think you're right that other people sort of, and this the boards did consider contract costs in. I've forgotten the months now, but it was either November or December. We did receive feedback that some people prefer to expense these costs. And you may recall in the 2010 ED that the board's proposal was to expense these costs. However, on that ED, we got feedback that people wanted to capitalize them. So there is quite a bit of tension here. But I think what we were talking about when you sort of just very specifically with your in relation to your pre-contract costs, those are costs that you have incurred in relation to fulfilling a contract. So it's costs that you're incurring when you've already received that contract. In terms of the cost of obtaining a contract, because you may incur...
That's not pre-contract costs. You've already got the contract, and you're starting to...
No, you did but not you... set up the contract. You're not kick-started the contract. You have got the contract, but you have not started executing the contract.
Some of the things that we think about there is in construction, sort of mobilization costs. So you need to get your equipment to the site to begin the contract. So those are some costs that you would incur before the contract begins, not necessarily before the contract was obtained. That's what we're.
It's not. It's, yeah, it's like software. If you have a software maintenance to India, for example, you have to migrate the data from somewhere to India. So you've got the contract. You have not started executing on the contract, but you have started moving stuff to that, similar to construction situation.
That's right. Maybe there is a way to help. When you say that you recognize that as an asset if you expect to recover the amounts.
Mm-hmm.
In some industries, you will say, I'm not sure to recover the amounts, so I will not recognize it as an asset. And in other industries, they would say, we are confident in the fact that we will recover the amount.
There's an interpretation there on recover. Yeah. Bullet. or amortize it over time, because some people would interpret recover as it's an ancillary cost over and above the contract. So I think you could have to, I think it's in the, it'll be in the drafting. If, you know, don't use, because I was on Malcolm's page until you explained it now. So I think it's more, delete the word pre-contract. I think you mean setup costs.
I think, you know, I think we were just, these are slides, and we're just trying to provide a bit of a flavor to it. But I can appreciate what you're thinking about. But we were definitely thinking that you've obtained the contract, but perhaps just not started it.
Alison, maybe the example you gave as moving the equipment is not the most helpful one, because I don't see how you can fulfill a contract without having the equipment on site and ready to work. So it's not part of what you build, but it is necessary to build. So and I will not put it as cost of obtaining a contract. It's more fulfillment of the contract, because it's a necessary task as part of what you have to do.
That's right. That's right. And that's in – sorry, I was sort of talking about it in the context of the right-hand side of that slide, the cost of fulfilling the contract.
It is an important point, though, and it and 81.1 and I guess IAS 11 have this notion of fulfillment costs that you can incur in anticipation of a contract. You know, like I think of a large construction contract where you're doing a lot of design work around. Okay, in order to even make the bid, you've got to go ahead and design, come up with the designs for the project. You can, at least under existing GAAP, you would capitalize that in anticipation of a contract. So I don't know if that's going to be addressed as well, but it's pre-contract. There is a notion of pre-contract cost. It's not as black and white as once you have executed the contract.
Yeah, and the ED would sort of, we have a bit of guidance about sort of what that sort of those contract costs, what they could include, and how you. The criteria that you'd have to meet in order to be able to capitalize them as a cost of fulfilling the contract. You know, I guess we suffer a bit from sort of just trying to make it very succinct here and just crisp, but hopefully that language shouldn't change that much, I don't think, from the 2005.
Remember why these things came into the revenue ED in the first place. These things came into the revenue ED because you're eliminating some other guidance on this as a consequence of issuing a standard predominantly in the IAS 11 or the SOP 81.1, which we have been very focused on getting certain contract costs into this discussion, because we are very concerned that in the revenue ED we don't want to bring costs into picture. But some are inevitable, like the pre-contract cost or to some extent cost of obtaining contract.
Yeah.
So we have been very focused on it. There are others which we need to discuss, but we have chosen not to.
And I guess the selling commissions comes from, I know in the U.S., the insurance practice of capitalizing. If you have a one-off, on signing the contract, if there's a one-off payment to the person obtaining the contract, then you would capitalize it. Is that?
It honestly came from the U.S. That's true.
I'm not so keen about it, I have to say that. So the selling commissions would be a one-off payment to the insurance salesman, for example.
Need not be insurance, but a lot of software have commissions, and they are typically, these contracts may run for 1 to 3 years, and you don't want to have inappropriately booking it. So the boards were persuaded at that time and continue to be persuaded that those selling cost expenses should be capitalized and amortized over the period of.
But it's the one-off payment on day one. You don't sort of do it.
You don't need to one-off payment. You can be in the middle of the period and say, yeah.
Malcolm, specifically on the insurance example, the commissions and fees are dealt with in the insurance standard as part of that standard. There's some discussion, or as part of that ED, there's some discussion about how it is or isn't consistent with the general principles and the revenue standard, but that issue will be dealt with within insurance. So I don't think
the focus is slightly different, though. In insurance, it's part of the cash flows,
right?
Because you're measuring the cash flows in that. Here, it is not the measuring of the cash flows.
It's just saying the insurance, a need for an answer in the insurance, is not what's driving
the software. Software came about. It's a software which came about.
So it's fair to say that the boards do not intend to change the current practices regarding capitalization or expensing of those contract costs, basically. We are not really intending to change anything in the cost area.
Well, I think practice is quite mixed at the moment, but the boards, just given the feedback, as sort of PK was mentioning, the boards are persuaded to sort of provide this guidance and these requirements. Maybe we could move on to disclosure and transition, which I presume is very relevant for all of you.
So on slide 13, we are talking about the disclosures, and the first part, I just want to remind you what the 2011 ED proposed. And so those disclosures were the disaggregation of revenue into categories that depict how economic factors affect the nature, amount, timing, and uncertainty of revenue and cash flows. There is a disclosure that was a tabular reconciliation from the opening to the closing aggregate balance of contract assets and contract liabilities. An analysis of remaining performance obligations for contracts greater than 1 year, i.e. the aggregate transaction price allocated to remaining performance obligations, and an explanation of when the entity expects to recognize those amounts as revenue, and a reconciliation of the opening and closing balances of assets recognized from costs to obtain or fulfill a contract with a customer. The 2011 ED also proposed that all quantitative disclosures for revenue should also be presented at interim periods. The feedback on disclosures was generally polarized between users and preparers. While preparers found the requirements burdensome, some users didn't think that the requirements were enough. You may be aware that because of these disparate views, the boards conducted 4 workshops in the US, the UK, and Japan in order to facilitate a discussion between both groups. These discussions were very successful and helped the boards better understand both user and preparer views and identified potential solutions that address both user needs and preparer costs. Feedback indicated the importance of and general agreement with the disaggregation of revenue, the analysis of remaining performance obligations, and to some extent the qualitative disclosures. And so the boards tentatively decided to clarify these requirements, which will include some implementation guidance on the disaggregation of revenue. On slide 14, these disclosure requirements were ones where the boards tentatively decided to make slightly more substantial changes. For both required tabular reconciliations of contract balances and of cost to obtain or fulfill a contract, as proposed in the 2011 ED, the boards replace these proposed requirements with a requirement to provide quantitative and qualitative information instead. The boards acknowledged preparer concerns about the cost to produce these reconciliations because the information was not readily available. In addition, although there was not explicit user support for the tabular reconciliation of contract balances, users did indicate a preference for more information on contract balances, specifically for more information on deferred revenue, which some consider to be the second most important number in the financial statements. The boards also discussed the proposed requirements for interim disclosure. The ISB tentatively decided to require only disaggregation of revenue at interim periods, and other interim requirements principles would remain under IAS 34. The FASB tentatively decided to retain the proposal in the 2011 ED, which was to require all quantitative disclosures at both annual and interim periods.
Any thoughts on that? Because we had good discussion in November on this issue, and I don't recollect anybody from this group participated in our disclosure thing. But you did participate in the U.S., in the U.K. In the U.K., sorry. Any thoughts? Any thoughts on how the boards have done? Hiroshi, you wanted to say something?
I welcome. There are some improvement reflecting the views of preparers, but there still remain some concern. The first is it's regarding the interim requirement.
Mm-hmm.
We do not support the decision of FSB. So they require almost the same level of disclosure as the year end. The ISB's decision is much better. And another concern is transition treatment. On slide 15, you move to the alternative translation method. So you require the cumulative effect, the B, and in addition, you require the disclosure of initial application. To cope with this, the company needs to use a dual accounting system to track the revenue for 2 years.
Yeah.
So I that's a significant burden.
But that's a choice, though. Alternative transition method is only a choice. You don't need to use it.
Is that a choice?
It's a choice.
You can do
retrospective and not maintain two sets of books.
Or all the other.
Okay.
So just that in a B and additional information is a choice?
Well, you can either apply the retrospective transition methodology as you would normally do, the alternative transition method, because it provides some relief in terms of comparative information on the financial statements. That's why the board decided to provide additional disclosures to help users to be able to see the trend information.
But for preparers, if you adopted the optional prospective application, it's the best for preparers. But even if you need to calculate a dual accounting system for 1 year, so I hope you alleviate it providing the significant effect. Or
well, the board did consider prospective application in the paper in February. We actually had, I think, four alternatives for the boards to consider, and they did consider prospective application. But I think that there was some concern, and we heard resounding feedback from users that they wanted to maintain their trend information, and that doesn't necessarily come with a prospective application. So I think all of these issues I think are very difficult, require the board to very carefully balance the views of users and preparers. So I think that was one of the motivations for coming up with this alternative transition method, because it seems to give the preparers some relief. I acknowledge that there is some work involved in transitioning, but it does try to maintain some of that trend information for the users. So try to strike a bit of a balance there.
But in case of alternative transition method, you require the amount by which each financial statement line is affected. Do you need that? If it's in a significant effect, we do not need to use a dual system.
Well, I think that the reason why that's required is because the comparatives are not restated. So you'll have prior year information under the old method. And in the current year, you'll have your information under the new method. And so just so that users can be able to track what has happened, they'd like some more information on what the new year would look under the old method as well. So it was to try and provide a bit more information for the users, but I do acknowledge that that preparers will need to track that information to be able to understand it. But to some extent, some of that will be known by doing that transition to the new methodology.
Olivia?
Am I right if I say that considering that the standard would be applied as of 1st January of 2017, if you apply the alternative transitional method, you will have to get a double method of accounting for 2017?
Yes.
To be able to explain the effects on
That's
the
right.
P&L. And if you choose to apply it on retrospective transition and you have only 1 year presented in comparison, you will have to get a double system in 2016.
That's right. That's right.
So anyway, you have to double your system 1 year.
That's right. That's right.
It's not double system, though, because in 2016, you are continuing your old system.
In
17, when you come, you retrospective. Yes, but in 17, you have to continue the old system.
Yeah, but if you have to be able to say for the year 2016, the amount we have published was that, and the amount we would have published to compare figures with 2017 is this, yeah. And this is not the same amounts. If the impact is quite important and you have to get systems to be able to find the figures, you will have two systems that will be applied in the year 2016 mm-hmm. in order to get the figures.
That's right.
If as it is on revenue is very large, the way you recognize figures is more complicated because you have 100 lines. So I think that you have to double your systems for a year.
And maybe I'll just take this opportunity to mention as well, like I think some of the feedback we've heard is 2017 is a long way off. And I think some people would have preferred sort of an earlier application date. But I think the board acknowledged that revenue is, it does touch many things. And we got a lot of feedback on that in the ED as well. So it is a little bit longer than usual, but they thought it was important. And actually also, based on sort of where we were in the ED and the publication timeframes, it's not that much further out than what we actually proposed. Because you may recall the board said no earlier than 2015, but that was on the basis that we sort of published in 2012. So now we're in 2013. It would have moved to 2016 anyway, and then that now it's just sort of one more year on top of that, which again, we heard a lot of feedback on as well. So...
Okay.
Good.
Yes, Bob.
Real quick, I know I'm cutting in the dinner, I mean the lunch. I want to make this real quick, but it's important for me personally to say this, that 10 years ago when this was added to the agenda, I thought over 10 years ago there was no way that this could be done. We believe my company will probably have the biggest cumulative effect of any company. I could be wrong on that, and it's major changes to us. We've said this before, it's maybe my last chance to say it in a public meeting before it's issued. The way this was done, the amount of effort and thought process and outreach that was done was incredible. And probably the best indication of the financial reporting community working together with your leadership involved in this process of trying to get something major that's done. I think, and maybe I'm talking out of line, this may be the most important and influential work that you'll do in your careers as standard setters, and it's absolutely outstanding job that you did with this, and just wanted to go on record. I'm actually be a little derogatory later in the afternoon, so I thought I'd stop.
Not on revenue, though.
Congratulations. This was just an outstanding job.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's a good introduction to a lunch.
That's a good way to break for lunch. Anybody, any thoughts on it?
Maybe we should have some champagne.
So let's meet at 1:20. Make it definitely 1:20 so that we can catch up on a few minutes delay.